Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 304 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And this podcast is going to be titled The Floridly High-Yield Trauma / Ortho Podcast, Part 2. So you can be like, Divine, so there's a part 1 to this? Yes, there is a part 1. Part 1 is episode 221. Basically, I will say this podcast is for a few groups of people. One, if you're taking the emergency medicine shelf, you definitely should listen to this podcast. Two, if you're taking a surgery shelf, you definitely should listen to this podcast. Three, if you're taking step 2 CK or step 3, you definitely want to listen to this podcast. In fact, this will likely be a series. But again, periodically, I'm just going to be making updates to this, right? So, Trauma Part 1 is episode 221 on the website. You definitely want to listen to that. Again, I'm sure there's many people that have in the past essentially gone through that podcast and done really well on their on these exams I mentioned because of stuff they saw there, right? So now this is going to be part 2, right? But I'm going to be including a lot of stuff from ortho, right? So one reason that I'm including a lot of stuff from ortho is I've noticed that a lot of people really struggle with ortho, and just sadly, many resources that are out there, the thing they try to do usually do is they just give you like the facts, right? Oh, let's memorize this ortho fact. Let's memorize this trauma fact. You usually don't get any whys, right? So you see people, they anki out these factoids, and then they notice that they get an exam question, but they are still unable to recognize it. They are still unable to apply that memorized information, right? Again, the best way to learn information is not just solely by memorizing it, but you need to understand and contextualize it. When you have the understanding, when something has been placed in context, then when it's presented before you on an exam, you almost by instinct recognize exactly what is being tested, right? So again, I will strongly encourage you, listen to episode 221, listen to this episode. It will help you tremendously. And again, this episode, I'm going to focus more on trauma than ortho. But again, in the future, I'm going to begin to present a lot of ortho material because I want ortho to be something that people have pleasure studying, like where they're like, oh, wow, this stuff is actually pretty easy to understand and remember, right? I'm not just memorizing facts. And then for those of you that are going to be taking step 2 CK or step 3 anytime soon, I do have an MBME test taking strategies class that's going to be taking place on the 27th of this month. It's going to be for 2.5 hours from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then for a comprehensive review, I have a 20-hour course. It's a Step 2 CK, Step 3 course. So anyone taking any of those exams will benefit from this. It's going to be taking place on the 28th, the 29th, and the 30th of this month, and also the 1st of May. So it's 5 hours each day from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Again, these courses have been taken by tons of people that have done really well on the exam. So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to shoot me an email through the website and I'll be happy to give you some more information. Okay, so let's jump right into it. So the thing with ortho and trauma, again, like I said, understanding very important. And then two, context, right? The MBME is very big on scenarios with this stuff, right? And again, I will try to make sure I hit on both fronts. Okay, so let's go to the first one. So what if they give you a question about a patient? And they tell you that, oh, this patient is in was in a high-speed motor vehicle accident. And then they bring the person to the emergency room and the person's blood pressure is like 60. Their palpable systolic blood pressure is like 60 millimeters of mercury. And then they tell you that, oh, a chest x-ray is obtained and you see a widened mediastinum, right? So again, they may either tell you there's a widened mediastinum if they're being nice, or they may show you a chest x-ray that reflects a widened mediastinum. I will strongly encourage you to make sure you can see and visualize what a widened mediastinum looks like, right? If you see stuff like this, I would really hope that you're thinking about this person potentially transecting the aorta, right? So this person has an aortic transection. Essentially, the ligamentum material, so must probably just cut through, like literally like butter, like a butter knife, slice through the aorta, and then the person is bleeding into their thoracic cavity. As you probably imagine, that's not very consistent with a very long life, right? So for usually for these people, your next best step is going to go ahead and become some kind of like surgical exploration. And they may even tell you that, oh, the patient has an inability to speak. Why do you think they will have an inability to speak in these circumstances? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, you probably have issues with the left recurrent laryngeal nerve, right? The left recurrent laryngeal nerve. Because remember, the recurrent laryngeal nerve does different things if you're dealing with the right side of the body versus the left side of the body, right? The left recurrent laryngeal nerve loops around the aortic arch. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And then remember that aortic transection is not, and again, it's surgery that's going to fix it, right? Like, again, there's no medication that's going to do diddly squat for you with aortic transection. Those people just ship them straight to the OR to give them like any chance of survival. Most of those people are going to die. They're probably going to die instantly or die before they get to the OR or die in the OR, right? I mean, the prognosis with this stuff is pretty bad, actually. So the thing is, if you see a YD mediastinum on an MBM exam, if you see it in the setting of trauma, think of aortic transection. If you see it in the setting of a person that has a history of like hypertension, think about aortic dissection, right? Think about aortic dissection. Remember, aortic dissection can present as a widened mediastinum, as a left-sided pleural effusion, right? And remember, when people also have aortic dissection, one thing that classically happens is they can have a myocardial infarction. And what's the most common MI that's associated with people having aortic dissection? I hope you're telling me it's an RCA infarct, right? Right coronary artery infarctions, right, have a very common association, especially again when you have an ascending aortic dissection, right? As that dissection is happening, if it's happening proximally, right, then that can essentially occlude the person's right coronary sinus. And if you do that, that's going to prevent blood from flowing in the right coronary artery, and the person will get an RCA infarct, right? So if you see a person having essentially like an aortic dissection like presentation, and you notice ST elevations in 2-3 and EVF, think about an RCA infarct, okay? It's one of these weird, bizarre things that you don't hear about many times, but it's fairly high yield to know for MBM exams. I'm telling you, you see an aortic dissection question, and you see ST elevations in 2-3 EVF, think about a concomitant RCA infarct, right? And then, so I said, if you see YD mediastinum with trauma, think of aortic transection. YD mediastinum with a history of hypertension, think of aortic dissection. If you see a YD mediastinum in a person that works in a textile factory, or a person that works with a TSA, or is an FBI agent, or, you know, some kind of person that works in a government agency, or a person that works with sheep or whatever. If you see that, I would hope you're thinking about anthrax, right? Bacillus anthracis. Remember, you can cause a hemorrhagic mediastinitis, right? Or again, you can also see aortic dissection in a person that has any of these, these connective tissue disorders, right? Things like Ehlers-Danlos, Marfan's, right? Remember, tertiary syphilis, aortitis. Because remember, syphilis torches a person's vas visorum. Remember, vas visora are the blood vessels that supply the walls of the aorta. So if you cause an arteritis of the vas visorum, then you're not going to be feeding the walls of the aorta very well. And then it's going to get ischemic and then dilate. And then you can then begin to have either aneurysms, right? Or you can begin to have dissections. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about a child that is struck by a motor vehicle going at high speed, right? And then they ask you, oh, where will the child most likely be struck? Will the child most likely be struck on the left side of the body or on the right side of the body? Well, think about this. And again, I'm going to go down a small rabbit hole here because, again, this stuff, again, don't see it in many resources, but it's very high yield to know for the exams, right? So the thing is, this child will most likely be struck on the right, right? This child, especially like a tiny child, you know, most likely be struck on the right. Well, why is that the case? Well, again, remember, if you're taking the USMLE, you're taking a US-based exam. Well, where do people in the US drive on, right? At least they drive on the left, right? So because people in the US drive on the left, again, when you're driving on the left, right, you're going to be seeing, if you're looking up ahead, you're going to be seeing just your left side, right? Most people are not saying, oh, let me keep scanning left and right, left and right, left and right. No, right? So the right side is the most likely side where they will have an accident, right? So they'll most likely, you know, strike a child or whatever on the right side of the car or whatever, right? So one thing I would just say is whenever a child is struck, one thing you want to think about on your MBM exams is something called Waddell's triad. Right? Waddell's triad. Again, I'm sure some of you have probably heard of this. Waddell, I think that's like Steph Curry's, like one of his names. Yeah, I don't know. I guess for the Golden State Warriors fans that are listening to this, and by the way, for the Golden State Warriors fans that are listening to this, I'm really sorry about what you're going through. I mean, it's been quite the unfortunate last couple of months for Golden State, but you know, I'm trusting God for you guys that things will get better next season. Okay, anyhow, okay, back to this. So, Waddell's triad, right? So the triad, and then I'll explain why the triad potentially happens, right? Is, again, the triad is when they will have a fracture of the femur, right? Usually like the shaft of the femur. And then they will also have some kind of associated intra-abdominal or intrathoracic injury, right? And then they will then injure the contralateral head. So you may say, okay, Divine, why do they, again, it's a triad, so there are three things in it, right? So you may be like, Divine, why do they have this triad? Well, the very first thing, why do they, if you think about a car, remember a car, there are some key parts that you will encounter, you know, God forbid, if you get struck by a car. You're going to encounter the bumper, right? The bumper is like the shiny part at the bottom, right? Like the front of a car. And then the next thing you encounter is the fender or the hood, right? That's kind of like the thing that covers the engine, right? So the thing is, when the child is struck, the child is going to be struck by the bumper first, right? And then when the child is struck by the bumper, that can lift the child, and then the child is then thrown, boom, on the hood or the fender of the car. Remember, again, the hood, they call it hood in Nigeria, you know, and I think in Great Britain. Remember, Nigeria was colonized by the British, and I'm from Nigeria. But I think in the US, it's called the fender, right? So you basically, that's the thing that you open up when you're trying to unearth your engine, basically. Right, so like basically reveal your car engine, right? So the child gets hit, boom, the child is like, oh, maybe the child is like trying to jump, right, and avoid the hit, and then boom, lands on the fender of the hood, right? That's the thing that causes that intra-abdominal or the intrathoracic injury. But then remember, that hood is kind of elastic in a sense, right? So when the child like bam smashes it, the child is then lifted off the car and boom, smashes their head on the floor, right? So that smashing the head on the floor is the injury to the contralateral head. Again, is it always going to happen in this way? No, but it's an association that you want to know for purposes of NBME exams, right? So they can present this as a question where a child is hit in a high-speed motor vehicle collision, and then they say, what do you look for? Well, you want to look in these three areas. You want to look in the lower extremities, especially around the femur. You want to look in the abdomen. You want to look in the thorax, and then you want to check out the child's head. Okay, you want to get brain imaging. You want to get a non-con CT scan first to make sure that the child is not bleeding in the brain. Again, you may say, Divine, wow, this question is really weird. And again, you notice I'm using a lot of scenarios today, but this stuff is super, super high yield to know for exams, right? And then again, remember, if a person has penetrating injury, right? So like gunshot wound, stab wound on an NBME exam, what are you supposed to do? I would hope you're telling me that, oh, we're going to go ahead and perform surgical exploration, right? They usually put this in the context of like abdominal injury or thoracic injury, right? In those cases, don't think twice. Just go ahead and go for surgical exploration, right? Fix whatever you're fixing in the operating room, right? Fix whatever you're fixing in the operating room. And then remember that when a person gets a stab injury, right? So let's say they tell you that, oh, the person was stabbed in the neck or whatever, or stabbed just above the clavicle or around the clavicle, right? Those people could potentially form AV fistulas, right? They can form arterial venous fistulas, right? So arterial venous fistulas. So what can those things cause long-term? Remember, those things can cause high output heart failure on NBME exams, right? So you may be like, okay, Divine, when does an arterial venous fistula cause high output heart failure? Well, let's walk with me here for a second, right? So the first thing is, when you create that fistula, you're literally going straight from artery to vein. Right? You're literally going straight from artery to vein. So you're cutting off the arterioles and you're cutting off the capillaries, right? Like literally blood is flowing straight up from artery to vein. Remember arterioles, if you remember from step one, arterioles are the resistance vessels in your vascular tree. So if your arterioles are out of the equation, then those resistance vessels are out of the equation. So your systemic vascular resistance goes down. So your cardiac output is going to go up, right? Now, all those arteries, as they zip blood right back to the veins, right? Then the blood goes straight back to the heart. So it's like the heart is like just getting this blood that's just zipping through the body and coming right back, zipping through the body and coming right back, zipping through the body and coming right back. Well, why is that a problem? One, that can cause tissue hypoxia, right? Because remember, gas exchange happens at the level of the capillaries, right? But if you've cut out the arterioles, you've cut out the capillaries, you've pretty much cut out the venules, then you're not going to have very efficient gas exchange. That's one. Two, the heart cannot adapt that well for so long, right? Because think about it. When you exercise, your heart rate goes up, your cardiac output, your stroke volume, everything goes up, right? For a season. After you exercise for a while, you know, you go home and relax, right? And then your heart also kind of takes a breather, right? You sleep and your heart also takes a breather. But if a person has an AV fistula, because the blood is zipping from artery to vein right back to the heart, artery to vein right back to the heart, and you've taken all those resistance vessels out of the equation, like the arterioles, the heart is going to work at elevated cardiac output all the time, while you're asleep, while you're awake, while you're chilling, watching an NBA game, doesn't matter, right? So because the heart is working that hard all the time, after a while, the person's heart will decompensate, because essentially the person has like a chronic increase in the myocardial oxygen demand, right? After a while, the heart, that's almost like it's not really a supply ischemia. It's more of a demand ischemia, right? Because again, a fixed amount of, you know, the heart is getting its blood supply, but it's just working too hard to for that blood supply to meet its needs, right? So you get a kind of chronic demand ischemia that's going to cause heart failure, right? The heart failure was caused because the person had elevated cardiac output, right? That's, again, high output heart failure. So these people's ejection fractions can be as high as 70%, 75% on an NBM exam, right? Like, really, high output heart failure is almost like a separate kind of heart failure, right? Because, you know, there's heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, there's heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. But high output heart failure is, think of it as like a separate classification scheme for heart failure, right? Because the thing is, ultimately, people that have heart failure preserved or heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, their hearts are giving out low output, right? Those are examples of low output heart failure, right? The low output can happen because your heart is not contracting well. That's heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. Or the low output can happen because your heart is not filling appropriately with blood. Diastolic dysfunction. That's heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, right? But ultimately, those people's cardiac outputs will be low, right? So think of those as like low output heart failures. And then there is high output heart failure, which has a peculiar mechanism, as I've described. And one genius question your friends at the NBME can throw on an exam is that they can tell you that, oh, you know, this person with high output heart failure, what will be true of their mixed venous O2 saturation, their MVO2? Remember, the MVO2 is the oxygen tension of the blood that gets back to your right atrium. I would hope you're telling me that it's going to be increased, right? It's going to be high. That's kind of like the same thing you get in septic shock. And in fact, this is why septic shock is also a potential cause of high output heart failure, right? Because the thing that happens is, because blood is zipping through from artery to vein, again, it's not, you're taking capillaries out of the equation, gas exchange is not happening, so your tissues are not extracting oxygen from that. It's literally going right back to the veins and right back to the heart, right? So because much oxygen was not extracted, then the MVO2, the oxygen tension of the blood returning to the right atrium will be higher than normal. Again, I definitely noticed, if I were you, again, you see people taking step 2 CK is almost kind of like the new step 1. You know, you see people come out of it, they're kind of scratching their heads like, man, what in the world just happened to me? These exams are so hard. Again, they're just trying to see if you can reason through things, if you can go beyond the classic. Again, it's the same pathologies they test, right? It's not like NBME can invent like a bunch of new diseases. No, right? You know, every now and then they test one disease that you've never heard of before or whatever. But for the most part, it's the same diseases they test. They're just finding unique ways of testing them, right? So this is like a very nice, unique way they can literally test high output heart failure, right? And again, if you want more information on high output heart failure, I believe you probably want to check out episode 273. It's literally a podcast where I talk about the different causes and the mechanisms behind high output heart failure, because you can get that from a bad anemia, you can get that from hyperthyroidism, you can get it from sepsis, you can get it from an AV fistula, you can get it from Paget's disease, you can get it by many, many different mechanisms. You can even get it by having a chronic tachyarrhythmia, right? But again, we're gonna skip that and we're just gonna keep going. Okay. Now, what if they tell you that, oh, you have this patient, this person that was in a severe trauma, right? Maybe like they were at work or whatever, or like in their kitchen, and their finger was like, you know, they mistakenly cut off their fingers, or a sharp object cut off their fingers, right? What are you supposed to do? What's your next best step in management on an NBM exam? Well, here's what I will tell you. Your next best step is you want to go ahead and wrap that extremity or that thing that was amputated, wrap it in a moist gauze, right? Put it in a plastic bag and then place the bag on ice, right? So there are three things you're supposed to do on your exam, and you need to do these things sequentially and in order. One, wrap it in moist gauze so it doesn't dry out, it doesn't desiccate. Two, put it in a sterile plastic bag. And then three, place the plastic bag on ice. Again, I'm sure some of you that have taken the USMLE exams have seen scenarios like this. These are things you absolutely need to know for your test, right? I mean, what if a person is in a trauma and is their tooth that falls off? Well, the thing you're supposed to do is you want to go ahead and rinse the tooth. Don't scrub it. Don't scrub it so that you don't demineralize the person's tooth. That'll be bad, right? Rinse the tooth and then place it in milk and then move the person to the hospital, right? Or you can even place it, there's like a special solution for teeth, right? That can keep it from demineralizing or whatever, right? But you want to get that person's tooth back into the socket as quickly as possible, right? That will increase the chances of the person having like proper healing. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a person that was in trauma or, you know, some kind of motor vehicle accident? And then the person is saying that, oh, wow, they tell you that in the question that on physical exam, he has like upper spinal tenderness or he has like hand weakness. Whenever you see any problems in the upper spine or you see problems with the upper extremities, you really, really on an MBM exam should begin to worry about the person having C-spine problems, right? You really want to worry about the person having C-spine problems, right? If a person has C-spine problems, your next best step on an MBM exam is obviously you're going to put him in a cervical collar. But the thing is, you're also going to get a lateral neck X-ray, right? Again, many people are like, Divine, but, you know, Q-banks, blah, 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 say I should do a CT scan. Yes, that's the right thing to do. That's what CT scans are a lot more helpful, right? But on an MBM exam, if you see a lateral neck X-ray or cervical neck X-ray, pick that first before a CT scan, right? If you don't see the cervical neck X-ray or the lateral neck X-ray, that's when you then have the license to pick a neck CT or whatever on an MBM exam. Okay, now what are some situations on MBMEs, right? In fact, I want to talk about intubation and the different ways your friends at the MBME love to mess up people on this stuff, right? So first things first, let's do the simple scenario. What are some classic indications for intubation on MBME exams? Well, especially in a trauma, you know, / ortho scenario. Well, if a person's GCS is less than 8, right? That's pretty self-explanatory. So, you know, you should know your GCS scores, right? Something should probably come into memory. But if your GCS is less than 8, or, you know, a person is not protecting their airway, right? Or they tell you that, oh, the person has like gurgling sounds. You can hear gurgling sounds when you're auscultating a person's chest or neck, right? Or you see an expanding hematoma in the neck, right? You know, these are things we all know, right? Go ahead and intubate. But again, the MBME, for the most part, they know that, again, we live in a flashcard generation, right? Again, I have not, again, I think some people listening to this podcast may think that, man, Divine must really hate flashcards. No, I love, I mean, flashcards personally don't work for me. Well, flashcards are great. In fact, there are many people that I work with one-on-one that I recommend that they use flashcards, right? But again, I feel like people, the crime that people commit with flashcards is, one, they memorize the information, but then they don't spend time understanding. In fact, I've seen like Reddit threads that, oh, has anyone done well on a USMLE exam by just straight up taking a flashcard deck and burning it into their brain? And then you see some people, they're like, you see, oh, yes, I did. I did this. I got 250, 260. The thing that those people won't tell you, again, many times online, you don't get the complete story. The thing those people don't tell you is that they probably actually had a good understanding from at least their med school lectures. So memorizing that information was them memorizing stuff that they already understood, right? So that's the thing. I have nothing against Anki. Anki is great, right? Anki is great. In fact, for me, I intrinsically can see the benefits of Anki, right? But the thing is, you need to understand and contextualize those things you see in Anki. In fact, if you make an Anki deck that forces you to have to explain pathophys and stuff, then that's a way more effective Anki deck than the ones that are just like they remove one word and you just remember the word. That's just the truth. Again, if you want to learn more about how to study appropriately, listen to my podcast on the central dogma of studying. It's one of my oldest podcasts, but it's like a very useful podcast, especially for people that are like studying med school. It will really help you learn how to study. Or for those of you that are still figuring out, how do I go through the study process? Actually go through, again, just logical reason as to why certain study methods are prudent and certain study methods are like imprudent. Okay, But let's keep going, right? So again, the MDME knows GC is less than 8, expanding hematoma in the neck, gurgling sounds, blah, 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 blah. They know that you know this stuff, right? So they're not, if you see a question like this, you should be thanking God, right? Because again, it's not something that you'll very likely see on an exam, right? That's way too easy, way too classic, right? But what will they do? Well, let me give you a few intubation scenarios, right? So what if they tell you that, oh, you have this person, the person was just intubated a few minutes ago, right? And then the person is really hypoxic. You notice that their O2 sats are not rising appropriately. And they tell you that this person is having worsening abdominal rigidity, increasing abdominal diameter. What should you think about? I hope you're thinking about esophageal intubation, right? I would hope you're thinking about esophageal intubation. Again, remember sometimes, instead of intubating the person's trachea, you intubate the person's esophagus, right? So you're literally pumping air into the person's stomach. If you pump it into a person's stomach or their, you know, small intestines and stuff, it will get distended, right? It will get very rigid and stuff, right? So think about an esophageal intubation. Usually in those circumstances, you'd confirm the diagnosis by getting a chest x-ray, right? And you notice that, wow, we don't see the endotracheal tube in the thoracic cavity, right? And you know, sometimes you can even notice, you may get an abdominal film and you notice that, wow, there's like so much air in the person's GI tract, right? So if you see that, think about an esophageal intubation. Obviously, your next best step will be to pull out that ET tube and reintubate the patient. Now, another classic intubation scenario they can tell you that, you know, a person again was intubated like 3 days ago, that, you know, the ventilator alarms, like on the third day after intubation, the ventilator alarms have been triggered, like, you know, triggered a lot, right? And they're reporting like higher than normal pressures. And then they tell you that a chest x-ray was obtained and they show you this chest x-ray. And you notice that the left side, so think about this, I'm not saying right side here, left side, right? You notice that, wow, the left side of this person's lung is like complete white out. If you see that, what should you be thinking about? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking of a right main stem bronchus intubation, right? Because remember, the right main stem bronchus is wider and is more vertical than the left side, right? Again, if you notice, all these things I'm telling you are things you probably heard studying for step one, right? But again, you see context, right? Context is very important on these exams, right? So the right main stem bronchus, right, is more vertical, is wider than the one on the left. So if a person intubates main stem bronchus, right, you're likely going to intubate the right side. Right? You're going to be the right side. Now, what are some high yield integrations your friends at the MBME kind of want you to know with this stuff? Well, the thing is, usually, again, if you intubate someone, and this is just something you should do clinically, right? As a smart person involved in clinical care, whenever you place something inside someone, it's usually smart to get imaging to confirm that it was placed in the right way, right? And in this era of like portable ultrasound, right? You should maybe be doing most of your procedures under like imaging guidance, so you can actually like see what you're doing. It's like getting a GPS for your procedures, right? It's just, again, one of these smart and, you know, in general, pretty prudent things to do, right? So the thing is, again, get imaging, right? Get imaging to confirm that the endotracheal tube was placed in the right place, right? And one thing the MBME can ask about this right main stem bronchus intubation, they may say, oh, Divine, what is, they may ask you, not me, thank God I'm done with all the USMLEs, oof, nah, I'm just kidding, but actually I'm done with all the USMLEs, but anywho, but they can ask, what is the biggest risk factor for right main stem bronchus intubation? Well, the thing you want to think about is emergency intubation. When intubation is done in uncontrolled conditions, right? Emergency intubation. The person is most likely going to have you have a higher than average proportion of those intubations being right main stem bronchus intubations, right? So that's why usually when you intubate, right, you know, you want to try to get the endotracheal tube, the tip, about 2 centimeters above the carina, right? The reason you place it 2 centimeters above the carina is that when the person, you know, when people are intubated, it's not like they suddenly stop moving their neck. If they move their neck down, the endotracheal tube is going to go down, right? You don't want to go down too much. That's why you give that 2 centimeter leeway. You don't want it to go down all the way so bad that it goes into the right main stem bronchus. And also when they lift their neck, when they lift their head up, it's going to come up, right? So that's why, again, you try to get it 2 centimeters above the carina, right? So some of you may be like, okay, Divine, why is the chest x-ray showing like complete whiteout on the left side? The thing is, that person has essentially suffered atelectasis of the left side of the lung, right? So you may be like, okay, divine, but why is there atelectasis? What's going on here? Why is the lung collapsing? Well, think about it. If you intubate the right main stem bronchus, air is literally not flowing to the left side of the lung. If air is not flowing, that will cause atelectasis. But that's not the actual reason why that lung collapses. Remember, if air is not going to the left side of the lung, blood is literally still flowing. Even if it may not be much, but there is blood still flowing through the pulmonary vessels that go around the left side of the lung. As that blood is flowing through, it's going to resorb or reabsorb all the gas that is in that left lung. So if you're reabsorbing all the gas that is in that left lung, but that gas is not being replenished because you're intubating the right main stem bronchus, then that lung is going to collapse over time. That's actually something on NBM exams that's known as resorption atelectasis, right? It's called resorption atelectasis, resorption atelectasis, right? Resorption atelectasis. That's something you absolutely want to understand. Your friends at the NBME, one thing that they've loved doing in recent times is just asking you questions about the mechanisms of atelectasis or the different kinds of atelectasis. They will literally put like many different types as answer choices, right? So again, sort of kind of something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? I mean, people can also have obstructive atelectasis where, again, they have like an airway obstruction. Again, if you have an airway obstruction, again, that blood flowing through your pulmonary vessels will reabsorb the gas in the person's lungs, and then that will cause the person's lungs to collapse, right? You can also have a compressive atelectasis, right? Say, for example, if a person has like a big pleural effusion or a pneumothorax, right? A pneumothorax, right, in the pleural cavity, that's going to squish the person's lungs. That's going to cause a compressive kind of atelectasis. Okay, still continuing with this intubation story, right? What if they tell you that, oh, you know, a person has been intubated, right? But then you notice that after a few minutes to hours, the person is getting progressively harder to intubate, right? And then they give you all these labs. You notice that the person has like a leukocytosis. You notice that their potassium is really high. They have hyperkalemia, right? If you see stuff like that, what do you want to think about? Or don't be telling me that, oh, divine, this person probably has like malignant hyperthermia, right? Because remember, many times when we try to intubate people, right, we're going to sedate them first, right? And then after that, we'll give neuromuscular blockade. I would hope you are not doing neuromuscular blockade before sedation, right? That's really bad. Imagine a patient still being awake, but then they can't breathe and all their muscles are like weak. It's like very distressing for the patient, right? So you need to sedate first before you give neuromuscular blockade, right? And you give neuromuscular blockade so that the person's airway muscles are more pliable for intubation, right? So remember that these inhaled anesthetics and these neuromuscular blocking agents, some of them have a strong association with a person developing malignant hyperthermia, right? Remember, malignant hyperthermia, if they have those problems, right? That's why they're like, again, you know, they get harder and harder to intubate and all those things, right? Because they have all this muscle rigidity. And remember, just again, for genetics reasons, malignant hyperthermia is actually inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. It's associated with mutations in either the dihydropyridine receptor or the ryanodine receptor. Right, either the dihydropyridine or the ryanodine receptor. The most common mutation is the ryanodine receptor mutation, right? So how do you treat this? Well, the way you're going to treat this is that you're going to give dantrolene, right? You're going to give dantrolene. Dantrolene prevents, is basically a calcium channel blocker. It blocks the calcium channel that we find on the sarcoplasmic reticulum in muscle, right? So it prevents calcium from being released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum of muscle, right? So that you can kind of stave off muscle contraction. If you stave off muscle contraction, then you can help the patient, right? So key things you want to associate with malignant hyperthermia, right? Again, you want to associate this with hyperkalemia, right? Because remember, potassium, because of the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, remember, that pump gets 3 sodiums out of cells and 2 potassiums into cells. Because they have, because muscle cells are literally dying, right? They are releasing their cell soup into the bloodstream, right? So the person develops a hyperkalemia, right? They can even get an acute kidney injury, right? They can tell you that, oh, their urine is red. And then you check you do urine microscopy and you see like 0 to 2 red blood cells per hyperbaric field. I've talked about this ad nauseum in many podcasts. That's pretty classic for rhabdomyolysis, right? Remember, rhabdomyolysis causes an intrarenal, right? Acute kidney injury, right? So that's why their creatinine can go up, right? So these people need aggressive hydration so that their kidneys don't get torched, right? And again, you need to also put them on a cardiac monitor, right? In case they start developing sequelae of hyperkalemia, you know, at wood punch, obviously, you want to give them a calcium compound like calcium gluconate or calcium chloride to stabilize the myocardium and, you know, things of that nature. You can even give them insulin with glucose, right, to drive some of that potassium into cells so that, again, they don't have problems. So you can give them albuterol, right? So again, high yield things to know with intubation. And I guess some other things I can mention here with intubation that your friends at the NBME love to test, right? If you notice that you've tried intubating a couple of times and a person is not, you're unable to intubate the person successfully, right? What's going to be your next best step in management on a test? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, I'm going to go ahead and perform a cricothyroidotomy, right? A cricothyroidotomy, right? That's a surgical airway. That's a surgical airway. And then what if they give you a question about a person and then the person has, was intubated, you know, for maybe like 2-3 weeks or a couple months for some bizarre reason. Again, you probably will never find that in the US anymore. But, you know, let's say the person was intubated for like 2 weeks. And then, you know, months later, you know, the person is alive and well. But the person has like some mild respiratory difficulty, has been having like all these sinopulmonary infections, right? And they tell you that, oh, on auscultation of the chest, you hear like an inspiratory stridor, right? Like a monotone whatever problem, right? If you see this, I want you to think about tracheal stenosis, right? I want you to think about tracheal stenosis. The thing is, when a person has that foreign, because literally, if you think about it, the endotracheal tube is a foreign body. Well, as we know, your body does not take too kindly to foreign bodies, right? So it's going to attack it. You're going to have like, that's why if you don't keep an endotracheal tube in place for too long, right? If you keep it in place for too long, that will give your immune system adequate time to attack it, right? And remember, whenever your immune system starts attacking things, right, it leaves a lot of dirt and debris in its wake, right? So all this collagen will be laid down. You have all this inflammation and fibrosis that can cause tracheal stenosis. In fact, on NBME exams, probably like the biggest risk factor for tracheal stenosis is actually having a history of prolonged intubation, right? Again, just one of those weird, bizarre things that your friends at the NBME kind of expect you to know for exams. And then, so I guess let's maybe lay off the intubation. I think I've kind of hit that pretty hard. So let's just go on to something else, right? So, and I'm going to wrap this up pretty soon. So what if they give you a question about a patient and again, they tell you that, oh, the patient has like some kind of penetrating injury or some kind of stab injury. What are you supposed to do to the stuff that they were stabbed with, right? So the thing is, your friends at the NBME, they will try to trick you into pulling out that thing like in the field or something. Don't do that, right? Don't do that. The always right thing to do, so for like the knife or whatever that they were stabbed with or the pick they were stabbed with or whatever, or, you know, got into their bodies. If that thing is inside the person's body, remove it in the operating room. Don't remove it in the field. Don't remove it yourself. No. Do it under controlled conditions in the operating room, right? Because in the operating room, you have access to resources and tools that you probably don't have access to in the field, right? The reason that you don't pull out this thing is the instrument that is inside the person may be tamponading the injury in question so the person doesn't bleed out and die, right? So again, just something you want to keep at the back of your mind. Again, just classic NBME scenario that many people kind of scratch their heads on for NBME purposes. Again, you don't have to be in that situation, right? And then let me just give you like a general rule for when you should never send the patient to get a CT scan. If you read an NBME question and you notice that the person is unstable, don't send them to a CT scan. Don't, right? CT scan is for stable people, right? So think of CT stable. You get CTs when you're stable. You don't get CTs pretty much of any sort on NBME exams if you're unstable, right? So like, for example, if a person has like blunt force trauma to the abdomen, if they're stable, of course, you're going to send them for a CT abdomen and pelvis. Not a big deal, right? But if the person is unstable, as evidenced by the person having like really low blood pressure, or the person is crashing and burning, super hypoxic, you know, severe abdominal pain, right? Signs of peritonitis. For those people, you're going to go ahead and do if a person has signs of peritonitis, you're going to take them to the OR for an X-lap, right? That's kind of like a different situation. But typically, if a person is unstable and they have blunt force trauma to the abdomen, the first thing you can do on an NBME exam is to do a fast scan, right? I think that's called like focused assessment focused sonography for the assessment of trauma, whatever it's called. Just remember, it's called a fast scan. And essentially, right, you use an ultrasound to scan like key places in the person just to make sure that they don't have like a blood or a fluid collection somewhere, right? If the fast scan is equivocal, you proceed to something called a diagnostic peritoneal lavage, right? If the diagnostic peritoneal lavage is unremarkable or it's equivocal, then you're going to proceed to doing the CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis, right? That's how you handle unstable folks, right? So just something to keep in mind on exams. If you're unstable, don't take them to a CT scanner, because if they crash and burn in the CT scanner, it's going to be technically challenging to get those people back, right? Just something to keep in mind for exams. Now, the last thing I want to discuss here, and then I'll wrap up, is this, I call it the bone vascular nerve NBME question, right? I call it the BVN, N as in Nancy, right? So the BVN, the bone vascular nerve NBME question. The NBME, they love the scenario, and people get it wrong like clockwork. Again, I'm saying this because I've worked with, again, you know, by the grace of God, you know, like thousands of students, right? Like, I've seen many people get this question wrong, right? And the way your friends at the NBME will set up this question is, there'll be some person in some kind of trauma or accident or whatever. And it will usually involve like the lower extremities. It will involve some kind of extremity, right? And then they will tell you that, oh, you know, physical exam shows like dislocation of XYZ bone or whatever. And then they'll tell you that, oh, you cannot palpate XYZ pulse this time, this, like you can't palpate this pulse, that pulse, this pulse, that pulse, right? And then they'll say, what is your next best step, right? And the thing is, many people, you know, they've been primed by all these study resources like, oh, no pulse, you got to fix that. No pulse, you got to fix that. Let me tell you this. Whenever you get an NBME question, we're in a localized area of the body. There's a bone problem, especially in an extremity. There's a bone problem. There's a vascular problem. So like no pulses, there's a nerve issue. Like the person can't sense anything. Always fix the bone problem first. I'll say that again. Always fix the bone problem first. That's why I call it the bone vascular nerve NBME question. Fix the bone problem first. After you fix the bone problem, then fix the vascular problem. And after you fix the vascular problem, fix the nerve problem, right? The reason you fix the bone problem first is, it's usually something you can fix pretty quickly. Sometimes, you know, obviously you load the patient with adequate amounts of pain control. You may be able to fix the bone problem at the bedside, right? Just go ahead and reduce the dislocation or whatever, right? Many times when you reduce the dislocation, because it sometimes, especially like in the lower extremity, right? When you reduce the dislocation, then you open up flow through the popliteal artery. And then the person's lower extremity gets perfused again, right? So fix the bone problem first, then the vascular problem, then the nerve problem. The reason the bone problem is fixed first is that it's usually most cases the easiest and the quickest to fix. And typically it's the dislocation or the bone problem that's causing the vascular and the nerve issue. So you're just basically going for where you'll get the most bang for your buck. First, if you fix the bone problem, chances are the vascular problem and the nerve issue will be fixed relatively quickly, right? Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and stop there. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step one, step two CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. Again, I've worked with tons of people that have been very successful, people that have even failed the USMLE exam. Again, I work with actually a decent number of people that failed USMLE exams, right? And again, thankfully, I have a very good record with these people, right? There are some of these people that are now residents, right? So again, just something to keep in mind. And then if you're a medicine resident and you need tutoring for the medicine entering exam or the medicine board exams, again, just feel free to reach out to me. And I'll be happy to give you some more details on cost and whatnot. And again, as I said, I offer USMLE courses, the Step 2 CK, Step 3 courses coming up pretty soon at the end of this month, as I detailed at the beginning of this podcast. And then I do a lot of application advising, right? So if you're a med student applying to residency, right, the ERAS application, again, we heard of all the horror stories that happened with this past cycle. The thing is, again, I've been on an admissions committee for like a year, and I've worked with many people that are now residents, right? I have very intimate knowledge of the residency application process. Again, I've worked with many people that have had super tricky applications, right? Like they failed the USMLE exam, they had to take a year off of school, they graduated from med school many years ago. I mean, I've had people graduate as far back as maybe 8 to 10 years ago that I've worked with and they've matched, right? So like, oh, because by the way, you know, getting to residency many, many years after you graduated, you know, is not the easiest task in the world, let's put it that way, right? But again, I've worked with people that have had many black, red marks or red flags, whatever people call it these days, right? And they've matched, right? So again, if you're looking for those specialized services, reach out to me. And again, you can never do this too early, because unfortunately, the time where everyone suddenly needs the help is the time where I'm so busy that then I'm not able to help everyone that I potentially want to, right? So shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you more information on cost and everything. And then, real quick, I want to share a quick life lesson today. And my quick life lesson today is the importance of obeying authority. Again, I mean, I've talked about this before, but I just think this is something that needs gentle reminders every now and then. I feel like, sadly, we live in a generation where, again, please don't misunderstand what I'm saying, where everyone wants to fight the power, right? They want to fight the authority, right? They want to complain loudly against authority. One thing many people don't realize is that there is such a thing in life as chain of command, right? The thing is, when you're obedient, right? The Bible even says that if you are willing and obedient, you will eat the good of the land. Many people are just disobedient, right? And it's almost something that's like encouraged in the media. It's encouraged in many spheres. Again, I'm not saying that you should submit yourself to be... like, if a person is like telling you to do the wrong thing, obviously you should not submit to doing the wrong thing. No, if a person in charge of you, an authority figure in your life, is saying do the wrong thing, no, don't do the wrong thing. No, right? But if someone has been placed in authority over you, just respect that person, obey that person. Because many relationships these days have been severed by just a person being unwilling to submit or being unwilling to obey, right? Again, I'm not going to go super, super deep on this. I hope that, you know, those of you listening will listen with understanding. But if you really look at many of the problems we face personally, as a country, as a world, in this day and age, especially in this current generation, a lot of it can track back to just being just straight up disobedient, right? You see people, they are working with a senior resident. Even if the senior resident, you know, is being a little hard on you, don't take that to start insulting the senior resident or bad-mouthing the senior resident, right? Or being disrespectful to the senior resident. No, there is such a thing as constituted authority. The thing is, if a person is treating you poorly, but you still show them respect, you still show them love, you still show them that, oh, you know what, I will obey you and I will do what you tell me to do. The thing is, you're kind of like the Bible says, you're essentially heaping coals of fire on that person's head. It may be that good behavior that that person sees in you that makes them say, you know what, let me change my ways. Let me be nicer to the next med student I work with. Or let me be nicer to the next resident that I work with, right? Again, there's a part of the Bible that says that your light should so shine before men, right? That they will see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven, right? So like, let people literally see your good works, right? Let people see your good works. Again, many times in life, it's not the circumstances you face that matter. It's the human being facing those circumstances that matters, right? So that's the thing. Again, I know that in this day and age is peddled in many spheres of life. In fact, I don't want to go into certain spheres because, again, I just want to be careful myself. But if you really think about it, think of it as an individual. Think of some of the biggest societal problems we face today in homes, in schools, in hospitals. A lot of it can be traced back to an unwillingness to submit, an unwillingness to obey, right? Again, just check people that have this track record of submitting, of obeying, of respecting constituted authority. Those people tend to have longevity and they tend to succeed long term. In the short term, they may look like fools to people. People may be mocking them. Oh, they are taking advantage of you. They are walking all over you. Oh, you are being stupid and everything. But just check long term. Again, the result of a game is not determined by the result at halftime. There are many basketball games I've watched where at halftime, you're like, oh, it's a blowout. This other team is going to win. But wait until the end. Don't count your chickens before they have hatched, right? So again, I'll just encourage you, obey, submit in as many areas as you can, right? The more you do that, the more you show a good example to other people, right? And one thing I will say is the fact that a senior or a supervisor has been mean to you doesn't mean you should then be mean to people that come through you in the future, right? You see some residents or some attendings, they are mean to MET students because they were, people treated them meanly as residents or as MET students. Don't do that. That doesn't give you the right. I will tell you that. That does not give you the right, right? So again, I'm just going to go ahead and stop here. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Again, this podcast is very high yield. I can almost guarantee you're going to get multiple questions on this, on the exams I highlighted at the beginning. So thank you for listening. I'll see you next time, and God bless you.